A very warm welcome to this World Game Changers podcast, where your host, Paul D. Lowe, embraces many crucial conversations that compassionately contribute towards creating a better life and world. Paul's intention is very simple, to help get people's inspirational insights and motivational messages out into the world so others may benefit.
Hello, listeners, and welcome back to this World Game Changers podcast episode. I'm absolutely delighted to say a returning guest, James Conroy Finn from just outside London in the UK. James, welcome back, sir.
Thanks for having me again, Paul. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, forgive the formality of sir, but anyway. So you may recall, listeners, previously we spoke around the meaning of life. Now, initially, I don't really prejudge anything, but that may suggest this is kind of philosophical, you know, kind of quite esoteric. It's out there. Maybe it is, maybe it ain't. But what I deduce personally from my first conversation with James on air, and certainly a couple of conversations off air as well, that this has got a lot more pragmatism about it, hasn't it, James? That very much reflects your world. My humble opinion, there's a lovely balance between how you come across, how you talk about things, between this seemingly polarized philosophical viewpoint on life, but also the pragmatic. That fascinates me. So any thoughts about that that intro there?
Well, the pragmatists were Americans, I think, if I remember correctly. And they were opposed to some of the more sort of, I guess what you're alluding to, these sort of navel-gazing philosophers, right, who live in the abstract. They had this attitude that I'm going to do things because they're practical. I'm going to do things because they have some sort of intrinsic value. They help me get through life. I suppose if you're more of a thinker, if you're a deep thinker, then maybe you do gravitate more towards the abstract. To some degree, I think there's a sort of unhealthy negativity around sort of intellectualism, around thinking about things. But I don't think, I think if you do it in the right ways, right? I think if you are thoughtful, that's a good thing. If you're obsessive, then you're probably not doing things in moderation anymore. So philosophy sometimes gets a bad rap, I think, because we associate it with maybe the navel gazing. But every human being is fascinated by some of these questions, like where did we come from? Why are we here? Why are things the way they are? We are a curious species, and I think we should celebrate that.
Definitely. You know, and that lays a foundation, doesn't it, for conversations like this of, okay, you know, you share your thoughts and views and vice versa, and other people will come in and, you know, who's to say who's right and who's wrong? We attach our own individual conviction to what we believe, don't we? To the point where, you know, people believe that in more radical, harmful situations that they want to destroy the world. They want that complete power. Versus that I'm just going to give myself selflessly to the world. And this whole kind of rich myriad of, you know, and I think there's something in there for everyone, isn't there? You know, and some people will argue their corner, despite the fact that they're decimating the planet, and others will, you know, counter that. And so this whole rich myriad, it just makes it fascinating on a collective throughout the world. But when you start to dig down into individual conversations like this, because for me, James, this is where the heart of it is. You know, we can look at things from a distance and we can read, you know, reports or listen to the news, which personally I don't, and get skewed perspectives. One might say even our own perceptions are skewed, but it becomes our reality, doesn't it, at that moment in time.
I mean, you're touching on some lofty ideas there. There's a talk I saw by a neurophysicist a little while ago, and he talked about, you know, we all we're all experiencing a hallucination. The difference between people who are labeled sane and insane is that we agree on a hallucination. None of us experience reality in any sort of true objective sense. It's an abstraction. It's an image that our brains create, and it only exists because it allowed us to survive and to procreate, right? It was the fact that we could see things in front of us and see big scary teeth coming towards us that are going to eat us, and then know I should run away from that thing. There was an advantage in being able to sense the world, and that's why we have these really unusual visual cortexes and experiences where optical illusions exist. Our brains have tendencies to prefer certain shapes. Gestalt principles. If you look into Gestalt principles, there are numerous examples of this. Arrows pointing in certain directions. We tend to see movement based on those arrows and those shapes. And that's something we all share. There's this sort of collective unconsciousness that's built into us. But it reminds you that it's all an illusion. It is all a hallucination. When you study physics, you start to recognize these things, that we don't really see the universe for what it is, that there is a sort of arrow of time, this idea that things are moving forward. But it doesn't seem that the universe actually cares about that. That's not intrinsic to the universe. It's something that we add when you put us into the equation. So we do shape the world around us. We do create these stories. We do experience. The other metaphor I heard someone use was that it's a bit like your desktop, on your computer, where you've got icons and you kind of click on the icon. Well, our brain has kind of created a desktop of the world around us, with buttons that we can click on and levers that we can pull on, and we kind of understand that we interact with this operating system around us. But as you say, it's a story. It is an illusion. It's and we have to get into the sort of definition of what reality is, right? And then we're probably getting philosophical. But no, it is a hallucination. It's an image created by our brains.
There's a kind of paradox there, James, is there not? When we talk about, and I'm gonna stretch this and give a skew on it, the harshness of reality. So let's paint that picture, whatever that harshness means to us as an individual. We'll all have our own takes upon that, which brings me into another one. Perception is all there is. But let's hold that thought. Perception is all there is. But this kind of paradox of harsh reality, isn't the reality of that reality that through philosophy, the more softer side, if you will, we can dilute that harshness. So there's a kind of complete, by looking at things differently, philosophizing, reframing it, call it what you will, telling ourselves a different story, that perceived harshness no longer becomes harsh.
Yeah, we create meaning, right? The universe itself doesn't. The universe doesn't tell us that something is good or bad. That's something subjective that we layer on. And when people talk about meditation, and I think a lot of people hear meditation and think this is some kooky thing where I dress like a Buddhist monk, right, and hum and ha and whatever else. The crux of what those people for thousands of years have been trying to do is to exercise their minds, like any muscle in their body, and get to a point where they can control that story that we tell ourselves. They have more influence over the way that they respond rather than react to the world around them. So when you hear about acts of war, when you hear about orphans and all these terrible things that occur around us, you can be very upset by that. You can choose to say everything is exactly as it should be. This is the way the universe works. If I want to have some positive impact on the world around me, I have to go out and I have to physically interact with it. I have to push and pull on the world. And if I don't push and pull on it, then it's outside of my locus of control. And if it's outside of my locus of control, then there's no sense in worrying, because I'm just beating myself up and making myself suffer. But to have that response requires exercise. You have to work at becoming more stoic, being more enlightened, as maybe someone of the Buddhist tradition might say.
I'll plant the football example, but before I go down another rabbit hole about the football example, let me go back to perception is all there is. Tom Peters. I can remember when I did my master's, James, 2002. in quality management. And as part of that that journey, that academic journey at the time, we studied the six great quality gurus. And gurus is not a term or that I personally, but that was how it was put across to us. And three were American and three were Japanese. And what was interesting for me, of these six eminent people, masters in the field of quality management, there were no two definitions from any combination that was even remotely aligned or close to each other, not even remotely. So we studied these six guys, as I say, three Japanese, three Americans. And we was asked to choose one, choose a definition, and then basically research it, explore it, rationalize it, et cetera, et cetera. The one I chose was Tom Peters. Perception is all there is. Simple pen. Is this a good pen? Closed answer, yes or no. More qualitative answer, yes, because it's, I don't know, good value for money because it only costs a euro and it's blah, 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 whatever. James might say, well, actually, Paul, is it a Parker? No, James, it's not a Parker. Well, it's rubbish then. Is it a shape for Paul? No, James. Ah, it's no good. Forgive me for kind of, you know, rejecting there. But, you know, listeners, I'm sure you get the point. Perception is all there is. And no two of these eminent people could agree on the definition of quality. And for me, the reason I did that course, that master's, James, in quality management was I come from an engineering, a very kind of, dare I say, pragmatic background, very science, very engineering, as I say. And so I was, you know, it was applied initially to processes, policies, procedures. And I thought, this must be something far deeper than this. If you can apply it to policies, procedures, why can't we use these principles and apply it to people? Never mind the pieces of paper and the manuals. Why can't we apply this to people? And that set me off 20 odd years ago. Well, I was already on the path before that, on the journey of discovery. But that really, particularly when I was introduced to the Kaizen continuous improvement philosophy, that really sent me on the journey of, okay, how can we as human beings, how can we, what is it? These intrinsic factors and maybe extrinsic factors that help us to be the best we can be and leave that legacy of, you know, to quote Dr. Stephen Covey's 9 Habits, leave the world a better place than it was when you got here. Any thoughts around that whole mixed bag, James?
Quite a few. So Kaizen and continuous improvement is something that we've, I mean, I've done a lot of work in software companies. And within software teams, we embrace these principles. We have these sorts of learning cultures. We talk about things like learning from failure. I would often say to people on my team, I don't mind us making mistakes as long as we don't make the same mistake twice. You know, we learn from our mistakes and that's fine. So we would have things like retrospectives, very similar to what they do in military context, right? After they fly a sortie, all of the pilots get together and debrief and they look at ways they could improve. You have to have a safe space to be able to take that kind of feedback. You have to have trust in the people that are around you. So it's not something that I think comes naturally. You have to learn the skills to be able to take on that feedback and to continuously improve. You mentioned the sort of pens. That reminded me of a logical fallacy. It's almost an appeal to authority, right? But then we talk about brands and they establish a reputation. And through that reputation, you think, well, maybe Schaefer is good. Maybe I associate the Schaefer with having a certain nib or a certain style that I appreciate. But it's a subjective idea, right? You're talking about because everything, you know, all we have is perception. That's true, that our experience is some subjective layer on top of everything else. And there isn't universal agreement over what is right and wrong. I would argue that there probably isn't objective morality, right? It is subjective, it's cultural. So trying to work out whether something is good or bad, I think what one of the frameworks that I've come across that I quite liked, I gave a talk on software architecture a while ago for the Office of National Statistics. And I spent the first half of it talking about classical architecture and Vitruvius. Vitruvius said that there are three principles that matter in architecture. There was utilitas or utility. There was venustas, which is beauty. And what was the third? I think the third was durability. So he had these ideas that something should be long lasting, that it should serve its purpose for a good period of time, that it needs to serve some sort of human need, and there needs to be beauty in that. I don't know that he really defined beauty objectively. That's where some of these Gestalt principles come in, that we do have some shared idea of beauty. There are certain shapes, certain forms. We like symmetry as a species. That comes from the fact that we are symmetrical beings. So when we see something that's symmetrical, when we see some of these patterns, we find it visually appealing. And those are kind of universally true. That's why you'll see certain shapes, certain curves, certain patterns in our architecture, in our art, in our creations, because it does speak to us all on a level that I think transcends culture. But then you have those nuances on top. Numbers come to mind. The number 8 is very lucky in certain parts of the world, and you will see the number 8 feature heavily. To somebody in the West, the number 8, it reminds me of when you were a kid in school and you got your calculator and you used to write boobies, like boobless and things. The number 8 to me is something that you turn upside down, it looks like a B. That's the association that I have with that number. But for somebody who grew up in the different culture, 8 is a symbol of kind of fortune and good luck. So there are ways I think you can. If you connect the dots, if you have that experience, if you're well traveled, if you meet lots of people, then you can come up with things that we will universally appreciate. But to your point, it does all still come down to perception. It's all going through the human brain and the human filter.
And I think within that, if process is even the right word, journey, call it what you will, that the underpinning thing, surely, James, is to have that open mind of, well, I don't really understand what he or she's saying. And culturally, God, is that what they really do in their continent? Oh, that's not right. That's not right. How on earth can you do that? That ain't right. Well, with respect, who are you to say it's not right? Yeah, but that's not how we do it in the West. Right. Well, that's how you do it in the West. That's not to say we're wrong in the East. So there's this whole kind of, yet again, this rich myriad, isn't there, of experiences. But for me, the underpin, the bedrock they're laid on, the consistency is having that open mind rather than, no, this is the way it is. I have a belief system. And I call it the oak tree because, that rigid, no, this is the way it is. Well, the problem with that, listeners, as we know, if the storms of life are too strong, it can come along and uproot that oak tree. Surely we're better off being metaphoric bamboos.
Yeah, flexibility is an asset, right? Open-mindedness is closed-mindedness is it's sad to see, I think, when you're closed-minded, when you're not open to new experiences. To me, when your mind ossifies in that way, it's the beginning of the end. It's a point of decline. If you want to enjoy life, you have to be open to new experiences. You have to recognize your own flaws, your own shortcomings. You have ideas about what's right and wrong. You think knife and fork go in particular hands, and this is how I should eat. And then somebody else comes along and uses their fingers, and you think, well, that's dirty, that's terrible, that's that they shouldn't be doing that. They have no civilization, no class. You're a product of your environment. And actually, if you ever eat with your fingers, it's quite a pleasant experience. We all did it when we were children, right? When you were a little tiny child and you picked up these things and you put them in, there's something very visceral, very fundamental about that experience. It's joy. You see people who've been starving, and you put food in front of them, they just gorge and they pick it up and they put it in their mouths, and that's almost spiritual. I as somebody with sort of obsessive compulsive tendencies, I would have to wash my hands first. There's these thoughts that go on in my head, and I recognize that I'm entirely susceptible to this as well, right? I see somebody doing that, and I think it's they've got jams on their fingers, they're going to get diarrhea, all these sorts of th thoughts pop up in my head, but I can recognize them as that. It's a thought that I carry with me because of my past, and I have these ideas, and I relish the fact that I can challenge them, right? I can take that step back and look at what my brain is doing and say, does that really make sense?
Yeah, I love what you've said there, because I confess, listeners, I do a lot of eating with my hands.
Oh, wow.
Consciously so. Consciously so. I enjoy it. And I've never actually stopped to sort of, well, why? Why do I? Because I just enjoy it and I do it. But, you know, like sort of as you've alluded to there, taking us back to that childhood and that real kind of basic, that base kind of instinct of, I'm connecting with my food. Food is energy. And I honor that energy. I honor that food. I honor that simplicity of being grounded and basic and real. You know, there's no fanciness here about eating with a fork and did I use the right knife? Did I use the right fork? I mean, you know, obviously this context, I'm talking about when I'm alone in my apartment, just me, myself, and I. And I spend, you know, consciously a lot of time in that, you know, in that space of solitude. Bliss, if you will. And then when I eat, it's kind of a relationship, an intense relationship with me and that food and that gratitude for that sustenance. So I think it, you know, what on the surface, I mean, you know, you go to the chip shop, certainly when I was, you know, a bag of chips, and you'd eat it out the wrapper. There was, you know, it's like, and it's so enjoyable and, you know, lashed with salt and vinegar, you know, hedonistic almost. Maybe I need to get out a bit more, James. I don't know, but
Go get some fish and chips.
yeah. Well,
I think you're right. It's if you're being grateful, you can recognize that actually these appendages on the end of our arms are quite miraculous. There are plenty of things on this planet that don't have these hands, and these hands are a large part of why we are where we are, right?
yeah.
These are our tools that allow us to manipulate the universe around us. The fact that we have these things, and we can pick things up. And we can be so delicate. We're able to paint and sculpt these tiny little things, and we can hold little tiny creatures in our hands without destroying them. That the real beauty in that sort of logarithmic ability, right? The very fine kind of operations at the very light side, and just enough strength to be able to crush a nut or rip open a banana, is profound. These things are beautiful, and if you can connect through the world around you, if you can use these gifts that we have to sustain yourself, it should be something that we appreciate, that we are grateful for. And I think we maybe too often take that for granted and don't pay attention to these gifts that we have.
If only opening cans was that simple.
Well, yeah, this reminds me of so when I'm stressed out about things, I often will think to myself, I've never been angry at a tree. It sounds silly. But the reason I do that, it frames my thinking. I'll get angry about a container that I can't open properly, the plastic wrapping on certain things that you can't get into, packaging that you need to have scissors or tin opener or whatever to get into. Drives me mad, drives me doodly. What? Who's made this thing? It's really bloody irritating. Trees, I don't get angry at. Nature, I don't get. When I'm walking around outside and I trip over something, I don't get angry at the floor. That's just the way it is. I don't get angry at a tree for being the way a tree is. It's the human stuff, right? Because you think that could be better. Somebody's created that. Somebody could do that differently. Whether it's healthy, I think that's an occasion when you get stressed by that stuff. Maybe take a breath, go for a walk outside. And that nice exercise I encountered a while ago was, I think it's people tend to say 10 minutes, 10 months, 10 years. Will you care about this thing in 10 minutes? Will you care about it in 10 months? Will you even remember it in 10 years? And that helps you maybe distance yourself from the annoying packaging or the cans that don't work or wooden cutlery. Wooden cutlery is something that drives quite a few of my friends doolally, the texture of the thing. When you mentioned fish and chips, it was the first thing that pops into my head, the sort of wooden forks, if you remember those. I didn't have a problem, but I knew people that refused to put them in their mouth.
Really?
They had the texture of the thing, can't stand it. And now that everything's gone away from plastic to wood, they go to any kind of fast food truck. They give them wooden cutlery, and they have to use their hands.
Fascinating. Fascinating. So, you know, in terms of what is the meaning of life, then bringing it back to kind of mainstream question, James, what is the meaning of life?
Depends who you ask, I think. I asked that question to some ancient philosophers. I think the Greeks contributed a lot in this area. They talked about arete, this idea of excellence. We should be pursuing excellence. We should be improving ourselves. And they talked about eudaimonia, a sort of happiness, a goodness. What they were essentially aiming for is some sort of fulfillment and trying to work out how we live a fulfilling life. And that led to Aristotle's principles, his virtues. Those then inspired sort of Christian virtues. These were things like contributing to something larger than yourself, being generous and donating towards the arts. It all fundamentally came down to being proud of yourself, doing things where you can look at what you've done and who you are and think, I like who I am. So, they were big on kind of restraint, ideas around stoicism, responding rather than reacting. I think there's still some truth to that. There's reason more modern research that shows people need some sort of connection to other people. There are a rare set of people who maybe don't need the connection and can pour themselves into their work, their purpose, and find happiness and meaning. They're people that you might associate with great works of art, some of the modern authors, maybe some of the modern scientists who didn't marry, who lived quite solitudinal lives. But for the majority of us, we need the oxytocin, right? We need that pat on the back when we've done a good job. It makes us feel good. We are social creatures. Dopamine we get from repetitive tasks, the reinforcement learning system inside of our brains. It's one of the, so anyone who works in software will know this. If you can get into a state of flow and you're solving problems that are just challenging enough, you get a dopamine release. And you can sit in front of a computer for 7 hours and not eat or drink, just chasing that high. Little problem, solve it, dopamine. Little problem, solve it, dopamine. And it just goes on and on and on. And your brain says to you, keep doing this. Because in, thousands of years past, that would have been chasing some prey. The prey appears, it disappears around a corner. You go around the corner and you see it again. And your brain says, oh, this is good. Let's keep going and finding that thing. It's food. I've touched on sort of oxytocin, they call it the love hormone. I think the love drug, right? It's the thing that helps babies form a link with their mothers at birth. You have to understand people's love language. So, do they appreciate gifts? Do they appreciate words of affirmation? If you can understand people and what they respond to, then you can use oxytocin to foster those sorts of relationships. And that's very rewarding for us. We have endorphins from exercise. Going for a jog, going for a bike ride, you'll have a high for quite a while afterwards. And then, obviously, the serotonin is the big one that your doctor will tinker with when they subscribe or prescribe you antidepressants. SSRIs or selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Those are the four sort of compounds in the body. Dopamine, there's a good way to remember dose. Dopamine, oxytocin, serotonin, and endorphins. Those are the four that we have to play with. And they all tie into some of these ideas that the ancient Greeks talked about, right? Connecting with something larger than yourself, pouring yourself into your work, creating things, being proud of who you are. We now have modern science to back up these ideas and say, well, that this is how our chemistry works. These are the things inside of us that will make us feel good. Behaving in certain ways will give you access to these free natural highs.
Very interesting. As you were speaking there, what was coming through to me was my own five values, the five L's: life, learning, loving, legacy, and loyalty.
Yeah.
And what you was unfolding there, James, really seemed to align with that. So life, the most precious gift of all, in all its weird and wonderful formats. So, okay, we've got this gift of life. What are we going to do with it then? We go on a voyage of discovery, learning. Learning about what? Well, that can obviously take many forms. I've already alluded to the academic journey that I've been on, many journeys of learning, but predominant learning about love. Because what I've come to understand, coming from a backdrop of violence, darkness, depression, addiction, etc., over decades. I'm not talking sort of, a 5 minute kind of bad period in my life. This went on for a long time, but the antidote for that is love, in my truth, in my reality, to take it back to the language we used at the top of this conversation. So this most precious gift of all, love, this most precious vital energy that sustains us, because without that, surely, and this is just my skew on it, we're merely existing. We're just existing. And I concede at this stage, listeners, there's maybe a semblance of judgment in that, hence my assertion that it's my bias, my experience, my truth, my reality. So we've got life, we've got learning, we've got loving. But then what do we do with this kind of gift of loving? I think what we do, because it raises our energy levels and that exudes, so we pass that love on to whoever, you know, other beings, whether that's our pets, our family, strangers, whatever that is, our lessons, our messages. We pass on love-related messages for the sustainability and the uplift of the planet, this beautiful planet and life that we've got. And so the final one then, so that leaves a legacy. But the final one is a little one that almost sits on its own, is loyalty. In that whole process, James, the loyalty to thine own, to quote William Shakespeare, to thine own self be true. Because how on earth can we be true to anyone else if we can't be true to ourselves? So, as I say, when you were speaking there, I thought, I could strongly align with some of those philosophies you was highlighting, because that really encapsulates, for me, my five L's, which are, you know, I look at this and people say, well, you know, what are your values, Paul? And I'll say, you know, and I know them off by heart backwards because they are me and I am them. Are they the only five then? Of course they're not. Of course they're not. You know, fun and family and finance, you know, these things are important as well. But they, for me, are more transient. But those five are my real solid foundation. How important, James, do you think, you know, our values to us, generally speaking, are they transient?
So values are an interesting way of better understanding yourself, and through that understanding, planning your future. Some of the coaching work that I do, values come up. We look at what we value, and the way to identify your values is to look at times in your past when you've been proud, when you've been happy, and to think about the people that you respect, that you admire, and to ask yourself where that respect and admiration comes from. If you go through that process, you can gain a better understanding of yourself. One of the things I've seen happen is the first time people tend to look at their values, they can be skewed by their fears. So they might talk about financial stability. I value financial stability. They don't really value that. They're just scared of not having it. It's not what they really care about. It's just something you've been conditioned to know that you need. I value a full belly. It's similar to sort of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? He had this idea that we need these sort of fundamentals in our lives to be able to reach a more spiritual level of sort of self-actualization.
Yeah.
A lot of people are critical of some of these ideas, but we can all agree, I think, that you need to have a full belly and, you know, a roof over your head to be able to maybe sit down and write a fantastic book. If you're starving hungry out in the pissing rain, then you're going to struggle to maybe create your best work.
Yeah.
So once you can get past those fears, I think you can start really thinking about what you value. I did this exercise a while ago. I value curiosity, creativity, excellence, adventure and influence. Those are my top five, and that's based on my professional career, my personal life, the people that I admire, the things that I think make us a wonderful species. There are, as you say, other things that I respect and admire. I didn't mention things like sort of stoicism, steadfastness, kindness. You know, I do value and appreciate those things, but those are, for me, like fundamentals. Those are on the sort of ladder up to where I would love to be spending my time. I would love for people to be able to, I think it was, I forget the exact quote, but there's this sort of specious notion that we all have to earn a right to live. But Mr. Fuller talked about this idea that the world would be a better place if everybody could go back to what they were thinking about before they were told they had to earn a right to live. I would love, I think we would see a new age of flourishing in our species if people could go and spend time on the things they're passionate about, the things that they're curious about, and were able to create, were able to master something and demonstrate their excellence, to be able to witness the excellence of other people, to be able to explore and see new parts of the world, to adventure, and to be able to influence. And spread that positivity. To me, that sort of is about us moving forward and reaching a higher plane of existence. To get there, we have to have that good meal, and we have to have a roof over our heads, and we have to feel relatively safe. You can't feel like someone's going to steal all of your work every time you turn your back. So we kind of have to work our way up that ladder. But when you go through the exercise, if you think about those values, if you can get past the fear, the more primal, and get into the sort of self-actualization, then I think you can really find something that speaks to who you are and will help you make decisions in the future.
What a beautiful way to end this particular podcast episode, James. Thank you so much. Any final thoughts before we sign off?
No, I'd just like to say thank you for having me on again. It's always a pleasure chatting, and I hope anyone listening gets something out of this. If they have questions, if they want to reach out, you can find me online. Welcome an email. Otherwise, I look forward to future conversations.
What is your best contact details then, James?
If you go to my, I mean, if you Google my name, I am the only James Conroy Finn in the world. If you Google me, my name, jamesconroyfinn.com, you'll find my website. You can there's contact information on there. You can drop me an email. I'm on a few. I'm not on Facebook and things like that anymore. I kicked myself off of those platforms, but I'm on Mastodon, where I respond to people who reach out to me. You can get to me through email as well, and I'm on a bunch of other sort of, I'm on GitHub and things like that. If you're into code and stuff, you can go and look at some of the rubbish code that I've written and open pull requests to improve my work anytime.
Brilliant. So there we have it, listeners. Hope you enjoyed that. I certainly enjoyed it. I find it fascinating talking to James. This dance that we have between pragmatism and philosophy. It certainly is where what my world's built upon. So anytime I have or opportunity I have to talk with a like-minded practitioner, boy, do I embrace it. But I'm going to leave it there, and I'm going to sign off the way I always do by saying, remember, the world's changing. How will you respond?
Thanks very much for listening to this World Game Changers podcast episode. Hopefully you found it interesting and helpful. Drop a line to Paul at worldgamechangers.org with any thoughts or questions you may have, and he'll be more than happy to respond. Remember, the world's changing. How will you respond?